I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, for many Americans, the term terrorism, at least since September 11th, 2001, conjures images of violent Islamic jihadists. However, in light of recent tragedies, such as the Pittsburgh and Poway synagogue shootings, as well as the Charleston church shooting, which targeted one of the oldest black churches in the United States, there has been renewed alertness in regards to domestic terrorism perpetrated by far right-wing extremists, and in particular, white supremacists. That being said, this is not the only time in recent memory when racially motivated terrorism has arisen as a major concern in the public consciousness. Domestic terrorism began attracting more scrutiny in the 1980s due to the activities of paramilitary white supremacist organizations such as The Order and the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. In the minds of many, this culminated in the tragedy of the Oklahoma City bombing on April 19th, 1995. Until September 11th, 2001, it was the deadliest terrorist attack in United States history, and in terms of domestic terrorism, it remains the worst of all time. How, though, did this particular brand of terrorism come into being? Our guest on this edition of Parallax Views, Stuart Wexler, author of America's Secret Jihad, The Hidden History of Religious Terrorism in the United States, argues that its origins can be found in a fringe religious movement known as Christian Identity, and that it reaches back to at least the civil rights era. Stuart Wexler makes his case for the existence of America's Secret Jihad in the following comprehensive conversation. But first, he shares with us the uplifting story of how students in his government and politics class at Hightstown High School in New Jersey recently made history by drafting the Civil Rights Cold Case Records Collection Act, which, due to overwhelming bipartisan support, was signed into law by President Donald Trump. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to my conversation with Stuart Wexler. Welcome to Parallax Views. Stuart Wexler, author of America's Secret Jihad and co-author of The Awful Grace of God, Killing King, and Shadow Warfare, which you co-wrote all three of those with Larry Hancock. Welcome to the show, Stuart Wexler.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Stuart, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about yourself before we sort of dive into the topic. Maybe your background. You cover a lot of issues related to the history of white supremacist terrorism. How did you get involved in that topic, and what is your background?
So my background's political science and history, and I've been sort of a historical researcher since I was even in high school. And a lot of my focus was on political events in the 1960s. And so what happened was we were investigating, we being Larry Hancock and I, we were investigating the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. And then we got sort of, I want to say, I guess the best word would be diverted onto the Martin Luther King assassination. And I could go into more depth on that, but to make a long story short, that took us in the direction of white supremacy and specifically to the ideological underpinnings of what amounts to a lot of the white supremacist terrorism that really became much more obvious in the 80s. We found evidence that it was present as far back as the late 1950s when it comes to violence. So that sort of King then led to a wider sort of exploration of that angle, specifically Christian identity and its influence on terrorism then and now.
And that's the genesis of the book we'll be talking about, America's Secret Jihad. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, you're a high school teacher at Hightstown High School, I believe, in New Jersey. And your students recently made a major achievement politically. And I always like to give good news on this show. So maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about that. I believe it's an act called the Civil Rights Cold Case Collection Act. Your students actually helped get that put into law.
So it sort of sprung out, and we could talk a little bit about that if you'd like. It's a interesting transition. It sprung out of my frustrations in researching America's Secret Jihad. And what eventually happened was my students, I didn't push them to do it. They sort of experienced the same frustrations with me. And really what that amounts to is the weaknesses in the record declassification system we have now under the Freedom of Information Act. And so my students ultimately wrote, drafted, edited, and lobbied for the Civil Rights Cold Case Records and Collection Act, which is modeled on the JFK Records and Collection Act, which will, once we get the nomination and the appropriation that we believe will hopefully be forthcoming in the next month or so, we believe that what that will lead to is a massive release of files on civil rights cold cases from the late 1950s on through hopefully the early 1980s.
So essentially cold cases that are related to hate crimes.
Correct. To the civil rights violence of the 1960s especially, a number of those cases went unsolved, and they were reopened and closed all over again. And so the hope is that we will be able to get these records out to the historians, the investigative reporters, and the families, and just the public at large, so that people can investigate and maybe solve some or some element of these crimes themselves.
Well, I wanted to ask maybe one more question about the Civil Rights Cold Case Collection Act. It's very heartwarming, as always, to hear about younger people pushing for things politically. I mean, we see that with Greta Thunberg now, the climate change activist who's just 16. We're seeing that with your students in this case. I'm curious, is this the first time that high school students have done this? It seems pretty unusual. I mean, they got it passed under Trump. I think it's a great achievement.
We are the first, from all accounts that we can have, and trust me, I've had people research this 10 times over, we are the first high school class in American history to have ever drafted a bill that was signed into federal law. So my students really pulled something impressive off.
Wow. Well, I'm hoping that keeps going forward and we see more young people sort of getting involved in this way. And I think in the coming years, we're going to see a lot more of involvement from the youth. I don't know what your take on that is before we move on to America's Secret Jihad.
Not only do I think it's likely to happen, I'm very anxious for these folks to take their place in public life, because the kids I've taught over the last 15 years or so, contrary to the criticisms that are often floated around the internet, I got the young millennials and Gen Z. They're amazing. I think that if, as long as we don't bury them in an impossible situation, they have a realistic chance of saving the world, because their hearts are in the right place. So I actually have a lot of faith in the future, provided that the current generation of political leaders don't completely blow it.
Well, I would add to that, too. I always hear people accusing youth that are more politically aware of, they're just young kids. They're not, they're not autonomous. They can't be talking about politics. What do they know? I think it's actually the youth that have the most to say and are probably the most curious, whereas, you know, a lot of people when they're older, you know, may not be as open to that curiosity and sort of changing their viewpoints as much.
Well, I find the kids nowadays, they like to have their viewpoints challenged. They often are willing to change their mind. They're, I think, yearning for political information and political knowledge. So I agree with you 100%.
And are there any final updates you have on that Civil Rights Cold Case Collection Act?
Well, there's a couple. We're hopeful, but maybe if the listeners out there want to check to see if their congressperson happens to be on an appropriations committee, we're trying to – the Senate and the House passed two appropriations bills for the review board. The act creates a board of people who are independent and review the records and decide what can be released and what can't. And that could be pushed back against by the central government. That's a whole other story. But the hope is that this board will get the money it needs to staff itself. The House gave it quite a bit of money, and the Senate gave it money, but we're hoping that in conference committee they lean towards the House direction. The second thing is we need the president to actually point people to the board, and we have some hope that that might happen soon. So the ultimately, what we're hopeful, or at least I am, that in the next month we'll see progress. And then the second front is the bill originally allowed for access to state records, because many of these crimes were investigated first under state jurisdiction, and that got nixed. That got edited out of our bill, not by us. And so what's interesting is folks, the first group of people in Tennessee saw what we did And now there's a class in Tennessee that's going to push for a local statewide version of the same kind of bill. We were even directly quoted in their bill. And so there is some hope that we can make this sort of a nationwide effort state by state to get at those same kind of records, not just the records from the FBI.
And I'm sorry if I'm belaboring this portion of the discussion, but I wanted to ask.
About this, trust me.
I just wanted to ask, because it just crossed my mind, how did your students get the momentum for this? I mean, it sounds like they organized a lot of momentum into this. How did that sort of come about? Was there a lot of social media outreach and trying to talk to people in political positions?
So my students did a few things. First off, we reached out to some pretty big-time media outlets. We were in the front page of the Washington Post. But that was sort of came afterwards. The sort of initial media push we got was a student of mine published an article in Politico about what we were doing, published an op-ed. And so that really kind of added some juice to what we were doing, both giving us sort of legitimacy when we go to meet with lawmakers, but also showing the students that it wasn't all for naught, that we made progress before the end of the first year. And we continued to get pretty good media coverage, certainly newspaper media coverage as we went on. And the students did, we went to Washington, D.C. The students went into congressional offices and lobbied staff members directly. I wasn't in any room, and they did quite a good job of that. And then as things got going towards the end, we actually had a massive sort of social media outreach, massive in terms of the energy we put into it, not necessarily in terms of who necessarily responded, to get the attention of the president so that he would sign the bill, because we were literally maybe an hour away from being pocket vetoed.
I remember hearing in one of the interviews you and one of your students did on it that you actually got, you know, close to, someone within the administration or talked to people within the administration that said they were going to try to get Trump to look into it.
So one of the things we did, because we were in an all out, all points, all hands on deck sort of desperation push in the last 72 hours, we put up a screenshot of, or on the board in my classroom, a New York Times article that had pictures of all the so-called midnight advisors for the president. And it was almost like a murder board. We went down the list. I mean, people were calling casinos, and we were trying to get a hold of, because there's some of those midnight advisors, we were trying to get a hold of anyone, Rudy Giuliani, anyone who could get a hold of the president.
Wow.
And we had mixed success as we went along, and then we reached Christopher Ruddy from Newsmax, and he got very interested and even talked to and exchanged emails directly with one of my students. And he said to us, I sent the message out to the president, meaning I think a text message. And that may have, and there may have been other people who did it on our behalf. We had some people say something about our work on Twitter who never got back to us directly after we emailed and called. So he may have gotten more than one call saying, hey, why don't you do this? So yeah, that was sort of a three-pronged attack. Midnight advisors, tweet at the president every time he tweeted. We had the whole school doing that. And going through the Congress people who we knew were very close to Trump and asking them to contact the president. I think all three of those probably played a role in it getting passed.
Well, I guess in conclusion, with regards to these great students you have that have made this, to me, it's an accomplishment. It's something very special. Are your students, is it a very diverse sort of background amongst your students? Anything you can say in particular about your students that pushed for this?
I would put the diversity in my suburban high school up against just about any school in the country. I've taught, for instance, a world religion class with 10 people, and I had 7 religions. It's everything many second generation children of immigrants. We have a large South Asian, we have a large Latin American population, decently large African American population, Jewish, dozens of countries actually. Many, many students speak two languages at my school. And it's amazing. I think that allowed in part for the sort of camaraderie and teamwork that was necessary to get something like this done, is they're so used to working with people who are different that they work in teams very, very well.
Well, I was just going to say on that note, I think it shows that when we have all kinds of different people living together from different backgrounds, you know, the sort of lie that we all can't work together, that fades, that it falls off, the mask of that lie falls off, and we begin to realize, oh, my friends and neighbors, they may look different, they may practice a different religion, but they're still my neighbors. And I think that is sort of what these students of yours have demonstrated, and I'm very grateful to them for, you know, being politically active and pushing this bill forward.
So on that front, with my honors kids this year, the big project that we're doing is we're trying to tell the social history of our town, because we were, even though we're in central New Jersey, you couldn't distinguish us from what a small town in Nebraska would look like 80 years ago. We were rural, almost entirely homogenous in one race, a little bit of religious diversity, but not very much. And we went through a lot of sort of, you know, ups and downs, but by two generations, exactly what you said. It's amazing in my school to see just how diverse the friendship groups are. And, you know, nobody's perfect, but I think we really do illustrate that we're a type of that the fears people have about diversity are just completely unfounded. And we had those fears as a town. That's why I want to tell this story. It's not like, you know, we were the perfect evolution from small, homogenous rural town to diverse suburb. But that's a story that needs to be told. We keep on hearing the stories of, you know, hillbilly elegy. Maybe the other story needs to be told. Maybe the story of the type of town that made a change needs to be told. And we're hoping to do that.
Well, I appreciate that. I think it's a good corrective to this sort of – I mean, you mentioned hillbilly elegy. You know, I'm not a big fan of the people who swoon over, you know, the author of that book, J.D. Vance. I think there's a whole other side that needs to be told, and that's the side that you're telling, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I hope we tell it well. We're going to try and put it in book form, in documentary form. And it might be ambitious. We started it last year. The next wave of kids are doing it this year. I have a much better idea on how to get a handle on it. And the worst case scenario, next year everything gets finalized. But I'm hoping maybe by the end of this year, we have something really solid that people maybe around the country would want to look into.
Well, you know, I think this is a good segue. You're trying to tell the hidden history of your town. But you've also told the hidden history on a national scale with this book, America's Secret Jihad. I think people may be confused by that title initially, because it's about white supremacist terrorism in the U.S. Going back years, I mean, way before the 80s even, when a lot of this came on the radar. But I think people see that word jihad and they're like, oh, it must be about, you know, Wahhabist or Salafist terrorists, Muslim terrorists. But this book is about a different kind of jihad, and I feel like your use of that title is you have a very specific reason for doing that.
Yeah, well, I kind of wanted to attract the person that maybe in the bookstore to pick up the book or the library with one particular thought in mind, a sort of, frankly, semi-crazy thought that there's like some sort of, you know, hidden underground Salafi jihadist effort to turn us all under Sharia law by people who don't even understand what Sharia law really is, and that they'd start reading, and what the story that might emerge for them is that wow, it's possible to pervert any religion to extremist means if you pull on the right strings and are willing to take enough things out of context. And so, to your point, the type of jihad that I'm talking about is from a radical offshoot of Christianity known as Christian identity.
I wanted to get into Christian identity because I feel like, you know, I've talked to people about it and they've said to me, well, that they're just a bunch of kooks. And I'm like, yeah, they are kooks, but they're very dangerous. So maybe you can explain what Christian identity is. And I'm sorry if I interrupted you for a second there.
No worries. So Christian identity, it has a fairly recent in the history of religion lineage. And origins go back as far as the 19th century. And what happened is a sort of mix of white chauvinistic anthropology that really wasn't very scientific at all, scientific racism, and just old-fashioned sort of Christian-inspired racism. They all sort of merged together such that by the mid-1940s, it cemented as a solid, fully realized ideology, again, that later would be called, more like 20, 30 years later, Christian identity, and which refers to a set of beliefs that basically reinvent and retell the narrative of the Genesis story in the Bible to be a story of two different seed lines being produced. One seed line, it's the conventional story, comes from Adam and Eve via their offspring Seth. And that is going to produce white Europeans under Christian identity theology, who are the real so-called chosen people. The other, much more idiosyncratic idea, is that there was a relationship between Eve and the serpent, who is Satan in biblical theology. And that produces a demonic offspring. In Christian identity telling, that demonic offspring are what we would call Jews.
They call them the synagogue of Satan, these Christian identity
Correct.
People.
Right. They're the synagogue of Satan, and they are considered demonic imposters. So, for instance, Ashkenazi Jews would be viewed as literal children of the devil, who are part of a demonic conspiracy. And that conspiracy involves the third group of people, people of color, who are subhuman. They're the offspring of humans and the so-called beasts of the field that are described in the book of Genesis. So they're subhuman and therefore manipulatable. I guess that's a word. They are capable of being manipulated and they're malleable to the evil wiles of the demonic imposter Jews. That's sort of the origin story. Where that becomes very dangerous is how they rewrite the end of the Bible, which is the book of Revelations. In their mind, the end times, the Battle of Armageddon, is a race war. It's a holy race war that's sort of genocidal in nature.
Is that what they call Rahoa, racial holy war?
So a lot of different groups use Rahoa. It sort of has its origins in a related group called the World Church of the Creator. But multiple groups, pagans, racist neo-pagans, they also borrow heavily, and we can maybe talk about it, from Christian identity. They also use Rahoa, and people in Christian identity, they might not have used Rahoa as an abbreviation, but they were talking about a racial holy world war in one way, shape, or form, all the way back to the 1950s.
Wow. And also, so these Christian identity people, they sort of are tied into British Israelism. So there's this idea that they have that it's the Europeans are the true Jews. And the
Correct.
I believe there's a whole thing about the Khazars. These are the
right.
Fake Jews, and I noticed they reference an author a lot. I don't know if you know a bit about this, but they always like to reference Arthur Koestler. I see a lot of anti-Semites who are obsessed with him because he wrote a book about the lost tribes of Israel. They seem to have very eccentric obsessions that are hard to parse out.
Right. Well, they go back to even before Kessler to other people who were sort of Victorian anthropologists. And, you know, no one's really dug deep, but my own sense of in looking at them is they're trying to explain, maybe even justify British imperialism. And so they reverse engineer, so to speak, a new anthropology, which says that, you know, some of the lost tribes of Israel, which, I mean, is in the Bible, that's not even really a well-explored concept even, but they have some lost tribes of Israel remaining in place in Judea and then others being spread out to other parts of the world. Some of them are the descendants of the, again, the demonic Jewish seed line.
The serpent seed line is what they call it, correct?
Right, and then the other seed line forms what is going to be the basis for white Europe over time, over hundreds of thousands of years. And so their idea is that the people who call themselves Jews are really, again, from these imposter tribes, from this imposter seed line, and that Jesus was part of a particular set of tribes and that one seed line. And they very selectively take out quotes from Jesus in the New Testament, referring oftentimes to just one small segment of Jews, and they sort of blow those up into a complete condemnation of Jews of all stripes. And it reaches ridiculous lengths because if you just look a few sentences up, Jesus is actually in the process of trying to preach to and convert Jews. So they're very, very selective.
That's one of the things I've always noticed about people with a fascist bent of any sort is their ideologies are always incoherent. There's no coherence to the ideas of the sort of neo-pagan fascists. There's no coherence to the Christian identity people. I would even say these paleocons, people like a Pat Buchanan, and I'm not saying they're all exactly the same, but all these groups, there's holes you can poke in them very easily.
Well, a lot of it's because they're essentially reverse engineering. They're trying to justify through their religion how, I mean, on the surface, although of course it's been involved in violence throughout history, I think Christianity, especially since people have become more educated and literate, you read the New Testament, kind of hard to get past passages like love your enemy, beat your swords into plowshares, and to then go out and commit terrorism. But the way they justify it is by trying to define people outside of the orbit of Christian concern. So you can have somebody like Sam Bowers, who we'll talk about, who was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi, turn around and literally teach Sunday school, but order, you know, killings directed at Jews. And he will turn around and say, well, those Jews, they were the synagogue of Satan. They weren't human beings. I don't have to love them.
It's really horrifying that there are people like this. But as I said, I think a lot of people will – I think a lot of people dismiss the influence of Christian identity on terrorism for various reasons. I think a lot of people just don't even know about it. Maybe that's where we could start, though. I want to talk a little bit about – there's three main characters in your book, I would say. And the one that you refer to as sort of the father of this unholy trinity of three, this trio, is a man by the name of Wesley A. Swift. Maybe you could tell me about Wesley Swift and explain to my listeners why this person matters and how it ties into a broader picture of understanding white supremacist terrorism in the United States.
So Wesley Swift was a racist seminarian from originally New Jersey, unfortunately my home state, but he went out to California where a number of other seminarians were sort of dabbling together in trying to come create sort of what they believed would be a coherent theology built around anti-Semitism and racism. And so he's one of the earliest seminarians who sort of codified Christian identity. But he's the most significant of all of them by far because he becomes their chief evangelist. He's like this sort of weird mix of Rush Limbaugh and Father Coughlin. He runs a radio network out of Hollywood, basically, that has tons of listeners in the immediate area, but which is also, over years, by the 1960s, those sermons that he puts out, Christian identity sermons, get widely disseminated by way of a tape exchange amongst, I would use the word, elite white supremacists. So it spreads, not just in North America, even as far as Europe, but also behind the scenes, within his group, the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, which very astute, knowledgeable listeners would recognize as the Church for the Aryan Nations, is the sort of almost like a front for a sort of almost secret terrorist organizations. They're not all that secret, but their association with the church. And they basically become the feeder program for a number of different white supremacist terrorist organizations in the country. Swift might not say, go and blow up these synagogues in this town. But he's very much like a jihadist imam in the sense that he's radicalizing people and giving them the broad directions. And then that's where you get what I think you'll probably refer to as the other two people who are really a big part of this story that I tell. One is J.B. Stoner, and the other one is Sam Bowers, who I mentioned earlier. And they're really going to take Swift's sort of message and convert it into violence. Although Swift had his own, again, violent apparatus, especially in California.
Well, let's get into Samuel Bowers a little bit. You describe him, if Swift is the father of this unholy trinity, then Bowers is the son, and you say he is the purest who commands a group of followers as they put the Father's plan into earthly action. In other words, he's the one pushing the followers to commit these acts of violence against Jews and other racial groups in America.
Yes, yeah, so Sam Bowers is a Mississippi-based white supremacist, but like a lot of people who ultimately embrace Christian identity, he's definitely a cut above in terms of intelligence and education. He went to my alma mater, Tulane, for a while. He was in the Navy, and he was also he went to school, I think, at USC in California. And so somewhere in the night, I believe when he's going to college, but we have nothing definitive, he really makes a turn. He almost has a religious conversion experience. And he starts blending these ideas together. And so when he becomes the Grand Wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi, which will, during his tenure, earn the reputation as the most violent Klan group in America, he has a very cohesive plan, however sort of warped it might be, to try and ignite that race war that we were talking about earlier. And his goal is to use the violence in Mississippi to basically draw in a federal response.
You're talking about the Mississippi burning.
Well, that's one of them. Initially, even the Ole Miss race riots, it's not so much intended, but it sort of is the sort of template for what they hope would happen, which is dye-in-the-wool racists, including members of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, are there inflaming people. The federal troops come in, and that inflames the regular Mississippi, I would argue, you know, semi-bigoted at least, person. And that's what their grand scheme is. They can't just go with their small members of true believers. They need the whole crew. So they need white Americans to become radicalized.
Well, let's give a little bit of background here. You said the Ole Miss race riots. That I believe has to do with James Meredith, who was trying to apply at a school and was a black man, and it caused a lot of consternation with people who believed, no, we have to have segregation. I think it was George Wallace that said, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. People actually believed this back then, and people don't realize today that there are still people that believe it. And there's a lot of people, I think, that don't realize that people really did believe in segregation to a point where there is no compromise, there is no integration. These people really believed in this, going back to the early 20th century. I mean, and farther back.
Right. So, I mean, just to take a step back and go back to the history of Christian identity, a huge part of what influenced it was the work of William Cameron, who was the editor for the Dearborn Independent, which was Henry Ford's periodical, which reached hundreds of thousands of people in the 20s and was actively promoting, with Henry Ford's approval, things like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which are just horrible anti-Semitic conspiracy tracts. So people totally believe it, and white supremacy was a fundamental component of the Southern way of life, and segregation was a huge part of that. And the governor of Mississippi, that wasn't George Wallace, refused to let James Meredith in 1962, even though it was court ordered. And so John Kennedy was ultimately forced to send troops down there to try and get James Meredith in. And the whole time that's happening, you have members of Wesley Swift's church, a minister by the name of Orrin Petito, along with a guy named Edwin Walker, whose connection to what Christian identity is not nearly as intense, they're stoking all sorts of anger amongst just sort of rank and file college students and other people at Ole Miss in 1962, and things get violent. People die. And so that is interpreted by people like Wesley Swift as a literal sign from God that the end times, the prelude to Armageddon, they're about to be on their way. But it's also a signal to a tactical person like Bowers. Well, if I can just inflame things enough in Mississippi, if I can just get a federal response, I can get the rest of white Mississippians to get up in arms, engage in violence. His thought was that blacks from around the country, black militants, would then come to Mississippi, and you would have the sort of fire that's going to become a forest fire that he believes is a race war. And you mentioned Mississippi burning. That was almost like the follow-up. That was, let's put this full plan into motion, kill these three people and civil rights activists in 1964 who are coming to lead Freedom Summer, which is a massive sort of voter registration effort in the South. Kill these three people, hide their bodies, which is not a common thing for Klan violence, hide their bodies, and that's going to bring in the FBI. And if you can bring in the FBI, well, then Southerners, in the mind of Sam Bowers, are not going to accept a federal presence in Mississippi, legacy of Reconstruction. They're going to fight back just like they did at Ole Miss, and it's going to be a matter of time to put race against race in his mind and ignite your race war.
Yeah, and I think people forget a lot of these events, or they're just unaware of them. I mean, between the Mississippi burning and the Ole Miss riots, I mean, you have the murder of Medgar Evers. I mean, a lot of people are unaware of this history, and it's a very important thing, I think, to remember, because I think there are still these forces trying to incite people to this kind of violence.
Sure. And if you look at, and maybe we'll talk more about it, if you look at modern, some of the most recent, in fact, acts of violence, the one that comes to mind most to me is what happened at Charlottesville. And so people look at a group like the League of the South, and this is very much the way they look at a group like the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi. They see their surface level propaganda and what the rank and file people who join the groups truly believe. And they say, oh, well, the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi, they're just a run-of-the-mill Klan group looking to protect the Southern way of life. And the League of the South, the modern group, they're just a neo-Confederate group looking to preserve Southern history and reinstate a, you know, a white supremacist South. But they don't look at the leaders of the group, who often hide their agendas from the group members. And if you look at the League of the South, which was behind one of the main groups organizing the Unite the Right right rally in Charlottesville that led to the death of Heather Heyer, you'll see that in the top of those groups, two of the main people, Michael Hill is one of them, are hardcore Christian identity. So you got to ask, to what extent are these folks like Sam Bowers manipulating the rank and file members who are certainly not anybody you'd want to have over for dinner, neo-Confederates, but manipulating them for provocative acts of violence in the hopes of creating a race war?
Well, I wanted to get on that. At one point in the book, you actually talk about how there were actually members of the KKK that thought that the Christian identity types were, like, even too far afield for them, would try to run them out of town and stuff because they're like, we can't have this.
Right. So, and they may not have been, these Klan groups may not have been fully apprehended the idea of Christian identity, but they recognized how radical some of these folks were. And so the third member of that Holy Trinity, J.B. Stoner, who is a lawyer who runs around the country basically stoking violence and sort of whispering in the ears of other Klan groups, which is why I sort of give him the idea, I give him the parallel to the Holy Ghost. These, somebody who, back to your point, I sort of semi-lost my train of thought. Your question again was?
I was just asking about the KKK. There were even members of the KKK that thought they were too radical.
Stoner was kicked out of the Ku Klux Klan. They said he was just too radical, and they couldn't understand why he was also so apt to engage in violence towards Jews. And later, he's so radical in his violence towards blacks that the Klan groups in Alabama, the United Klans of America, actually warn people off of associating with J.B. Stoner. And that's interesting because if you look at one of the other crimes I write about, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, those folks who are, and I believe they are guilty, and who were eventually put into prison in part by Doug Jones, who co-sponsored My Students' Law, those folks were hanging out with Stoner's people. They had lost sort of their cachet with the regular Klan. And I think it's very interesting that what wound up happening was they committed maybe the most provocative act of violence in Alabama, which is saying a lot. And that people who were Christian identity, we now know, showed up the day before and were planning on killing Martin Luther King when he came to town, which I know somebody who was on the ground down there, a civil rights activist, Reverend Ed King, and he was convinced it was just a little bit of a spark and it would have been mass violence down there. And if it was the killing of King, it would have been mass violence in his mind all across the country, which is exactly what the Christian identity people want.
Well, I want to get into J.B. Stoner a little bit more. You said he was a lawyer, I believe from Georgia, and you sort of refer to him as the unholy spirit of this trinity of three characters. But he's a very interesting character because obviously, the fact that he's a lawyer, I think a lot of people think all of the people within this far-right movement throughout our history, that they're just, these are just dumb, rednecks or whatever. A lot of these people are more educated, especially at the higher levels, than anyone realizes or wants to acknowledge. The other thing is that Stoner sort of played up this image of being, a country yokel, but he was very dangerous, and I think the fact that he was able to play on that image of just being a yokel actually benefited him. I mean, it seemed to keep the FBI off him in a lot of ways.
Well, so Stoner wasn't just a lawyer. He was a straight-A student in law school. I mean, he's going to get disbarred because he engages in crimes later on, decades later, but he's a very smart person, and one of the things that he's very smart about as somebody who knows the law is he makes sure he's out of town and that his fingerprints, literally and figuratively, are not on the bombs that are being planted in his name. And it took until the 1980s for him to be convicted for a bombing, even though local law enforcement in the South especially all knew that he was behind quite a few of the bombings. My book argues that there was a chance that he got away with masterminding the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. The evidence isn't solid there, but that's in part because a huge portion of that evidence that could probably settle things is still concealed from public view. And that is the wiretapping of his law office, which even if he wasn't involved in the 16th Street Baptist Church, if he wasn't a bomber himself, if he didn't design the bombs himself, he advised so many and was a lawyer for so many terrorists, frankly, that any bugging of his law office would probably be the mother lode of trying to solve some of these racist crimes.
Am I correct about that? That he was able to sort of evade a lot of notice a lot of times just because of how he came off? Okay.
So he would, yeah, so he, sorry about that. He, if you ever see him online or at these rallies, he looks like or presents himself like a country bumpkin, but he was far smarter than that.
Well, I mean, there was, I believe members of these groups would even say he was advising them on how to build the bombs. It boggles my mind that people like Stoner fell through the cracks for a long time.
Well, he would be the subject of investigations, but he did a good enough job of distancing himself. And, of course, there'd be pressure. So when he was involved in the crimes, for instance, one of the big grand wizards in the country who shared a law office with him, James Venable, you know, Stoner would represent Venable, and then Venable would represent Stoner or people who could implicate Stoner. And by the time he was done representing those people, even if they had told authorities that Stoner had something to do with it, they'd recant. And so he escaped for 20 plus years, at least.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's possible to find some of his speeches online. I'm not gonna link to any of them in this episode, but people can look them up if they want. I mean, he does have this millenarian religious view. I mean, he basically says, you know, he wasn't called to be a preacher, but he's still doing God's work through this incitement that he does.
And if you dig deep into Stoner, which many people have not done, I was probably the first one to really do it, you'll find one of the first things he did was write what would amount to a Christian identity tract. And he did that as early as the late 1940s. So, and that book was marketed within Christian identity circles. So the idea that he's so anti-Semitic, he forms the Christian Anti-Jewish Party, one of the first groups he forms in the 1950s. It's not an accident. He's under the influence of Christian identity from his early 20s.
I want to fast forward to the 80s when people start noticing Christian identity a lot more, but maybe just real briefly, you could talk about the events before the 80s and the hate crimes before the 80s that the Christian identity has a fingerprint on, or have their fingerprints on.
So I would argue plenty of events in the 1960s. We mentioned a lot of them. Ole Miss race riots, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, I believe they had an influence on. Definitely through at least Bowers, they had an influence on the Mississippi burning killings. And I have a whole book, in addition to chapters and books, on my belief that they motivated the assassination of Martin Luther King, You get into the 70s, they started to fragment a bit. After Swift died, they lost momentum, even as he was getting sick. But they show up in, for instance, David Duke's activities in the 1970s. David Duke's sort of mentor and closest, one of his closest advisors is a guy named James Warner, who's also, by the way, very important in the development of racist paganism. He's influenced by Christian identity. There's a guy named Mills who has plotted to blow up school buses. He's very much Christian identity. But they're much more fragmented in the 1970s, in large part because of federal and FBI pressure. But where I argue, and it still needs to be investigated, they may have had the most sort of prominent influence was in the Atlanta child murders, and which is being reopened. And I hope that those folks look at one of J.B. Stoner's closest allies, a guy named Ed Fields, who's still alive, and Stoner, because the sort of counter theory to the Atlanta child murders, which I think has a tremendous amount of credence, more so than you see in the Netflix series Manhunter.
Or Mindhunters, right?
Mindhunters, about that. They played down in many ways the evidence against the Klan as having committed some of the murders in Georgia. And if you look into that deeply, the motivation for the Klan group that did it was they wanted to ignite a race war. And you can imagine killing a bunch of black children. And it did, in fact, bring black militants to Atlanta, would ignite things. J.B. Stoner was right there trying to inflame the public while the killings were happening. But what people don't pay nearly as much attention to is the Klan family in question, the Sanders family, enjoyed very close relations with J.B. Stoner and Ed Fields, his closest ally. And they, again, were at that moment running paramilitary operations in the woods of Georgia to prepare for a race war. And the Sanders family was supplying those paramilitary groups with weapons. So I would love to get a hold of more of the GBI recordings. I would love to know to what extent Stoner and Fields may have actually influenced the actual killings. And that sets us up for when people really start to notice the Christian identity groups, and that's in the 1980s.
Well, I've always been very interested in what happens in the 1980s because I think it's a forgotten chapter in the history of the far right. You know, people talk about the alt-right today, and this, I mean, they're just the same far right to me. You know, but quibbling over how people use words aside, in the 80s it was really bad, and there's two groups in particular that I think people should know about, and one of them is the Order, or the Bruderschweigen, the Silent Brotherhood, who they actually assassinated a radio host, a Jewish radio host, for speaking out against Nazis. His name was Alan Berg. There's a for my listeners, there's a movie that Oliver Stone directed about Alan Berg called Talk Radio. And the other group is the CSA, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. Maybe you could talk about those two groups and how it sort of puts massive attention on Christian identity.
So the starting with the Order, as you noted, is most well known for having assassinated Jewish radio host Alan Berg. They had much greater plans in mind. They're one of the first groups that sort of takes inspiration, not just from Christian identity. Several of their members were Christian identity, and several of them become eventually the inspiration for a push and a shift towards racist paganism. But they're one of the heavily influenced by Christian identity, and they have plans for bombings and many more assassinations. They had an assassination list.
They were involved in major bank robberies too, I believe.
Correct. And they were planning on doing a massive counterfeiting operation that they hoped would bring down the financial system. And a lot of this, by the way, is motivated. They're one of the first groups I was getting at this before to be motivated by the book by Pierce that motivated Tim McVeigh, which is The Turner Diaries.
Yeah, William Luther Pierce, The Turner Diaries. It's a horrible, crappy pulp novel. Just that basically is all about, you know, we have to destroy the government. And there's all this talk of the day of the rope and murdering people that are not white. I mean, it's horrible stuff.
Right. And in many ways, as more than one person has pointed out, although William Luther Pierce was influenced by but sort of created his own religion, offshoot of Christian Identity, it's almost like a Bible to Christian Identity. It's like a how-to manual for Christian Identity people. If you want to use a comparison, it would be like radical books that are offshoots of the Quran for a group like Al-Qaeda. And so they're one of the first groups that's influenced by that. They take a lot of their including their name, from that book. And there also was, by the way, an Order 2. So after these folks were arrested, the Order 2, they actually were considering something that we'll talk about that the CSA was thinking about, which is poisoning the water supplies in various major cities. But the CSA actually obtained the chemicals to try and do that. They were based out of a Arkansas compound, and they were, again, they were fully Christian Identity. And they were somewhat incompetent in trying to pull off several of the attacks that they were, you know, planning on putting off, bombings of synagogues and assassinations, etc. But they had obtained most of the chemicals that would have been necessary to poison the water supply of the two cities they talked about were New York and LA. There's some reports that they were considering DC. And they had to be brought down by way of informants and an FBI, basically one of the first FBI raids or DEA raids.
What was the goal behind that? I mean, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, the CSA, they wanted to poison these water supplies. I mean, to what end?
Well, again, in their minds, if they can create a dystopian type of situation in a major city, they believe that that's going to be part and parcel of accelerating the end times. Same thing with the Order. They're all thinking there's certainly separatist vibes to both groups.
But these are millenarian cults, essentially.
Correct. They believe that one of the key things, not to get too much into theology, but, you know, mainstream fundamentalist Christianity believes in an end times. Many of them also believe in something called a rapture that will take up the elected or, you know, chosen people and take them away from what the next phase, which is the tribulation, which is this sort of onslaught of, you know, famines and wars and earthquakes. But the folks in Christian Identity do not believe in a rapture. They believe they're going to be left behind. Excuse, that's an ironic phrase, to actually participate in the end times. And so they believe they stockpile weapons and all that kind of stuff, in part because they believe they're going to be the warriors for their version of Jesus Christ. And they believe before that even happens that they can play a role, some of them do, in accelerating the process in the first place.
Well, this actually leads me to something I wanted to hash out with you. And it'll lead us to the Oklahoma City bombing, and then we can start wrapping up, is, you know, all of what you're talking about reminds me of the lead-up to Ruby Ridge, the standoff between the Weaver family and the federal government. And, you know, I think a lot of people are – I think there's a tendency to look at the situation with the Weavers and say that's horrible. You know, his family members – were killed, his wife, his son died in that incident, and I think it was mishandled. But there's this attempt on the sort of Weaver supporters' part to make it out that Weaver was just an anti-government guy that hung out with white supremacists, but he wasn't necessarily a white supremacist himself. And yet, I mean, if you watch documentaries, he was wearing shirts that say Zog is in control. Zog, of course, being the Zionist occupied government conspiracy, the Jews run the world. I feel like there's a lot more to the Ruby Ridge thing than a lot of people are willing to admit.
Well, all evidence indicates that Randy Weaver and his family were Christian identity. The only difference is, and there's a parallel in the jihadist world, Salafis are sort of like the Christian identity folks for Islam. Radical, very small, very weird and somewhat orthodox offshoot, right? But there are Salafi jihadists, and those are the people we know about, the Osama bin Ladens and ISIS, who believe they actually have to, you know, initiate action and terrorism. But then there's also what some people call quietists, people who are ready to join up and support those kind of causes, but they're passive. Weaver was the passive version of a Christian identity person. He stockpiled weapons. He fully expected there to be something like a race war. But he wasn't somebody who felt that it was his job to go out and blow stuff up to make the race war more likely. So he is no one you'd want to have over for a dinner party. He's somebody whose views are frankly repulsive. But it was mishandled, and the unfortunate irony of the mishandling is it actually radicalized people from being passive Christian identity people into being violent and Christian identity people.
I was going to comment on that real quick. There was a PBS documentary on the Ruby Ridge incident a few years back, and there's footage of the Weaver supporters, these white supremacists and Christian identity people, talking to the FBI supporters after everything has been finished, after Weaver gives up. And, you know, I remember some of the white supremacists were saying, "We got our martyr. We won." And they just sort of laughed at the FBI and walked away. I mean, they don't, you know, it's sad because, like, I think it's sad that Weaver's wife and son died, but these people didn't care about him or his family.
No.
I mean, they were happy about this. It got them what they wanted. They got their martyr.
The two galvanizing events for the radical right and not just Christian identity people were Waco and Ruby Ridge. And it's worth noting that part of the reason why the government overreacted to Randy Weaver was by the late 1980s, Christian identity was squarely on the map for people who were interested in terrorism. And in fact, I always tell the story, Bruce Hoffman, who's maybe the leading scholar on domestic terrorism in the country, when he writes a sort of summary report on terrorism in the late 1980s, terrorism that happened in the decade, he says, I'm not exaggerating here, that every single domestic right-wing terrorist group in the country, every single one, was under the umbrella of Christian identity. It might be a tad bit more nuanced with a group like the Order, but not much. And by the end of the – so they all thought that Randy Weaver was going to be the CSA, misunderstood. And then by the end of the 1990s, you get the Project Megiddo report, and it also – singles out especially Christian identity as being potentially very dangerous with the new millennium coming. And yet Christian identity basically disappears down the memory hole, even for terrorism experts, by the time we hit the 2000s. And again, even frankly, for people who, like Bruce Hoffman, who really know their stuff, they completely missed the influence of the Christian identity folks on mainstream white supremacist terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan in the 1950s and 60s. So it's very misunderstood, and I see it, and we could talk about it, I talked about it a little bit already, as somewhat making a reemergence. I also see it, as we'll get to, as being in the background of the McVeigh plot against Oklahoma City.
I really want to talk about Oklahoma City. It's been a very, it's a historical moment that's very important to me, because I feel like there's a lot of mistakes made by the FBI with it. I feel like there's a lot of unexplored aspects with regards to Elohim City. I may be mispronouncing there. And also just the background on McVeigh. A lot of people would say McVeigh is just was just an anti-government guy, and that's sort of how he's portrayed. I mean, even Gore Vidal, who I generally have liked, Gore Vidal, he befriended McVeigh and was like, "Oh, McVeigh was just a good old American boy who was anti-government." It's like, no. McVeigh was, you know, there was something much darker going on there.
So McVeigh, I don't necessarily dismiss the idea that anti-government was a huge and maybe one of the main driving forces behind what motivated his thinking. But there's two things that McVeigh almost definitely lied about when he was being interviewed towards his death. And then a couple of other things in terms of the nature of the crime that are worth exploring. One is he claimed that the Turner Diaries for him were just about were about guns and the anti-government element associated with, you know, gun confiscation. But if you read the Turner Diaries, like, the gun confiscation thing is like the first few pages. Everything else is like radical genocidal madness. And the idea that you only got out of the Turner Diaries, which McVeigh sold, like, he loved the Turner Diaries. The idea that that's the only interpretation you have, that it's like a gun rights book, is just not believable. And the second thing that's not believable is he joined, for a while, an Arkansas Klan group. And he claimed that he saw them as another one of these gun rights groups. Which, I mean, people are probably laughing at home. But you see, the thing is that people miss is the specific Klan group he joined was run by Chuck Robb, who may be, at this point, the leading Christian identity person in the country now, and he certainly was then. So you add that together. One, he's widely, he's basically in love with what, again, as I said, the Turner Diaries, which are like a handbook for Christian identity people. He joins a Klan group that has very strong Christian identity ties. And then, as you mentioned Elohim City. Elohim City was a Christian identity compound where we know, including that people, terrorist-type people, were living there, including Jim Ellison, who was the head of the CSA. He was married to the daughter of the guy who created Elohim City. And we know that Elohim City was also home to people who had plotted against the Marab building in Oklahoma City. That was not Timothy McVeigh's. He wasn't the first person to think about it. And it's certainly odd that we have records of him contacting Elohim City. And there's an informant report from a woman named Carol Howe that says he visited. And, you know, nobody's really returned to that in recent years. But when you see the stuff that was, she was lambasted as just a nut when she came forward for the defense in the McVeigh case and said, "Hey, I was telling people that these folks are planning a terrorist attack in Oklahoma City, and I saw Tim McVeigh," and she was just crucified by the government and by the media. But the more evidence that came out, the more it seemed pretty clear that she was indeed an informant there. And we don't have access to all the reports. Isn't that suspicious? And so it looks more and more like Timothy McVeigh. I don't believe he himself was Christian identity at his core, but I think he hung around in circles and with groups of people and was inspired by literature that was heavily influenced by Christian identity. And it's a decent chance that he was given a lot more help than people have noted by people who were Christian identity in encouraging him or assisting him towards what happened in Oklahoma City. I don't think Christian identity people plotted it, but I think they certainly helped Timothy McVeigh, who was the driving force with Terry Nichols, to pull it off.
Could we talk a little bit more about Elohim City? This, I mean, you said it was a compound. It's completely private. They're extremely secretive. They don't really want people knowing what was going on there. I don't know if it's still in existence. I've heard that it is, though.
I think it is still in existence. Again, it was a community that was basically run according to and lived according to Christian identity ideas. And again, it was like almost like a way station for some of the worst Christian identity terrorist types in the 1990s. And so, clearly they were a target for federal investigators who were interested in terrorism, especially in the mid-1990s when, you know, Christian identity-oriented investigations were the rage. But we also wonder if they were even infiltrated by groups like the ADL, who, of course, are trying to protect Jewish interests. But they were almost like one of those cult compounds that you hear about on TV.
Wow.
But for Christian identity.
Well, in terms of the Oklahoma City bombing, any sort of investigation into Oklahoma City bombing, I think there's a lot of elements that have really muddied the waters. There's this whole element of right-wingers that have muddied the waters, I feel like, in regards to the Oklahoma City bombing. And I was wondering if you could comment on that and explain it.
Well, I mean, let me first comment, I think, on the biggest muddying of the waters, which is there's good reason to believe, as I mentioned, Carol Howe, that the FBI had an idea that something like Oklahoma City was going to happen, that they had informants on the ground in Oklahoma City. And not that they made it happen or even provoked it, but that they could – but. You know, there's this tendency sometimes with investigation of terrorist groups of all stripes. And I write a lot about this in the book, America's Secret Jihad, that you infiltrate them. And infiltration is one of the most effective methods of dealing with terrorism. But you sometimes get greedy and you say to yourself, well, I can bring down the entire group if I just wait for X to happen. And if you don't time that right, X happens. You don't stop X, and you wind up in a situation where you have to cover up your involvement because you didn't stop it.
Can I comment on that real quickly?
Yeah.
I was going to say we see the same thing with the World Trade Center 93 bombing. You know, we had an informant, Imad Salam, who blew the whistle about, you know, he was informing on the cell that was – you know, making the bombs. And I guess there were all kinds of issues with the FBI bureaucratically and with Salam's handler, Nancy Floyd. I guess, you know, there may have been some jealousy involved. Like, well, we want to take credit for this, but she's going to take credit. And there were just all kinds of bureaucratic issues. So after Salam comes out, after the bombing happens, I mean, he left his job as an informant due to internal disputes. You know, it's not something that I think the FBI as an institution wants to talk about. So it's not conspiratorial necessarily. It's a matter of, you know, sort of pushing something to a side or covering it up because it's an institutional failure.
Sure. And, you know, there's less evidence of it than for 93, but there's certainly hints that with 9/11, that there was some serious interest by the CIA in possibly recruiting a couple of the guys that they didn't know. I don't believe, I certainly don't, that they were going to engage in anything like 9/11, but they were following a couple of the guys that there might have been an interest by the CIA in turning those people into informants. There's certainly a whole bunch of evidence that Anwar al-Awlaki, who's sort of like the guy who videos radicalized dozens of Salafi jihadists, that he was an FBI informant for a while. So, and of course, no one wants to own up to these kinds of things, and they wind up covering it up, and then you don't learn your lesson. So I think the evidence that it happened with Oklahoma City is actually pretty strong. But again, that's exactly why you'd muddy the waters. Now, in terms of other people, you know, sometimes the right wing likes to turn what is it actually a right-wing terrorist event into a conspiracy by the central government to, as a quote unquote false flag, to go after the right wing. It's a the ultimate irony, and Oklahoma City was frequently painted that way by people on the right. Oh, it wasn't McVeigh, it was A, B, and C, and it's a false, you know, some kind of false flag to justify the government going after the right.
Are you familiar with there's this one far right sort of militia character by the name of General Ben Parton, who he would go on these far right radio shows and say, the federal government
activity.
What's that?
He's the guy with the seismic activity that claimed that there was two explosions or something like that.
Right. He implied that, he's basically saying, it was like a controlled demolition almost.
Yeah. I mean, and again, you investigate the background of these folks and, you know, they may believe it confirmation bias wise, but they clearly have an agenda in turning what is, again, a right-wing terrorist event into a cause celeb for right-wing terrorists. So that's an unfortunate aspect of some of the post-Oklahoma City investigations. I'm wondering if there's going to come a time. Some of the people who've done extensive work on Oklahoma City since, you know, like as recently as, you know, a few years ago, they almost all, I mean, a lot of them believe that there's a lot more to it. But I think there's maybe needs to be a new wave of interest and maybe FOIAs and stuff like that to try and maybe get to the bottom of some of these, again, like the Carol Howe situation. Hopefully somebody somewhere is willing to say, yeah, we've really burnt her, but turns out she did in fact tell us in advance.
What do you have any final thoughts on the Oklahoma City bombing case? Like I said, I think it's an important historical precedent, and I think it needs to be revisited. I don't necessarily want you to speculate too much on what you think went down, maybe where the FBI messed up, but if you want to go there, or if you have any final thoughts on the Oklahoma City bombing and its relevance.
Folks would, I mean, if they read the chapter in the book, there's a whole chapter dedicated to it. My sort of, final thought on it is, I do believe that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols are still the driving actors, but I think you definitely have to look at the social context that created them, that motivated them for that specific attack, and even some people who may have helped them along the way. I don't want too much to go into depth on it, but it's hard to believe they built that bomb. So that's just amongst other things who helped them with that.
Well, I guess the last thing I want to get into is, the far right today and the possible influence of Christian identity today. It's interesting what you said about McVeigh, that anti-government may have been at the heart of his ideology, but he may have been influenced by Christian identity. I think about that a lot now because it's weird. The far right is very fragmented. I know a while back there was a fight that broke out at one of these far right rallies where the Oath Keepers were fighting with the white supremacist types. There's all kinds of weird fragmentations, but it's weird because if you look at the militia movement of the 90s, you have a mingling of people that are anti-government but not necessarily white nationalists, but they're mingling with white nationalists, and it just becomes a whole weird mess. I wanted to get your thoughts on that, and then I wanted to talk about the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh.
So, and that was true, by the way, also in the 60s. You have a lot of co-affiliated people, and that's why it's oftentimes hard to pin down what the exact motivation is, because different people in the same group have different motivations that align. So there's no doubt that Christian identity is anti-government. I mean, they think it's a Zionist-occupied government by Jews and, you know, the United Nations and communists and stuff like that. So a rank-and-file, pure-hearted anti-government person could have a nice, long dinner conversation with somebody in Christian identity. The person in Christian identity might not, depending on how they feel the other person out, explore the religious angle. but they would totally be willing to work together to do something that was anti-government. So these sort of co-affiliations where people align, and it's often a very tactical decision by certain, especially elite people, that they decide that if they join a larger group, they can create more havoc. And the sort of price for joining a larger group is they don't make much hay over their ideological motivations. And that's what Sam Bowers did. That's what J.B. Stoner did. That's what I believe the Hill, whose first name suddenly just slips my mind, one of the leaders of the...
Michael Hill.
Michael Hill, right. One of the leaders of the League of the South. That's sort of the strategy they take. Because if they go Christian Identity, they might be able to get 20 people. But if they're willing to be just more broadly anti-government, they could get 200 people. And if they manipulate things in the right way, they're accomplishing their goals at the same time that the other people are achieving their goals.
I want to clarify real quick. When you say these elite people, or when you say elite white supremacists, what do you mean by that? Because I think some people get a really conspiratorial image in their head when they hear elite.
What I mean is just the people who tend to lead and run the groups. And they often are people who are more educated. They're not elite in terms of social status or some kind of place in government. They're not like so-called Harvard elites or anything like that. They're just the upper echelon of these groups.
Although I do think sometimes they manage to get into political positions. I find it worrying sometimes. There was just a report by the SPLC about, I forget if it was someone in the State Department that was going on alt-right radio shows and podcasts. These things do happen. They do try to infiltrate various organizations.
I am more worried about that now than I've been in a long, long time, because I am worried about infiltration of police forces. A police chief in New Jersey just got busted, and he was saying things that Donald Trump is the last hope for white people. I'm worried about them infiltrating police forces. I'm worried about them infiltrating the military. I have students who served in the military. They've told me they think it could be 20 to 25% of the people they serve with, not necessarily Christian Identity, but white supremacists. And then I am worried about them infiltrating government. I don't even know what to make of Stephen Miller. But he, if there was a candidate for, if he wasn't, and being stereotypical here, if he wasn't Jewish, although his own uncle says he's betrayed the history, he certainly acts like a mole for Christian Identity or white supremacy would act if they were in a political administration.
Well, I guess that leads us to, one of the latest things you've covered just a little bit. Robert Bowers and the synagogue shooting that happened in my neck of the woods of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I know you were very interested in speaking to my listeners about the synagogue shooting.
So if you dig into Robert Bowers' Twitter feed, the very first clue to me was he quoted John 8:44, and that's one of these Jews are the devil's passages. By itself, one passage doesn't always trigger me, my interest, but it causes me to go looking. And so when you go looking in Robert Bowers' Twitter feed, as somebody sent me who follows my work, he put up a screen print of the Wikipedia entry for Christian Identity and spoke of it approvingly. You add those two things together with what he did, and I certainly think you could make a case that he was being influenced by Christian Identity. I even contacted the Pittsburgh FBI about it, and they seemed to – they didn't dismiss me as a kook, let's put it that way. It's even more obvious in San Diego with the temple shooting there, where in the manifesto, the shooter actually quoted 4 to 5 just absolute unique Christian Identity passages. He basically almost quoted the Creed. And I've done a lot of research into this. Other scholars have just asserted that this is, and with, I think, you know, background knowledge as experts on religion, have asserted that these passages are very unique to Christian identity. But I actually did like a quantitative study, and there is almost no chance, if you cite those four passages, that you're not Christian identity, or have been heavily influenced by them.
Do you think with the current developments, I mean, we've been talking about Christian identity's influence on the far right. Do you think that influence has waned at all? And that there, I mean, I don't, I'm not saying it's waned completely, but I mean, there's so, fascism has this ability to take on multiple different forms constantly. I mean, we have the pagan neo-fascists now. We have, you know, the quote-unquote the alt-right. I mean, do you think we'll see new forms of white supremacism going forward and new forms of white supremacist terrorism?
Sure, and it's worth pointing out, as I say in my book, it really did lose a lot of traction by the end of the 90s and in early 2000s in favor of racist neo-paganism and the World Church of the Creator. And my understanding is that Church of the Creator is becoming also is reemerging. But it's important to understand that both of those religions developed under heavy influence by people who were one time or were well aware of Christian identity beliefs. So, you know, it's a worthwhile criticism. Wexler, you're making too much of Christian identity. It's only because I know and have written about the influence, for instance, on Dylann Roof of racist neo-paganism, but the racist neo-paganism owes a huge debt to Christian identity. So it's important to follow the genesis of all these groups. And to your last question, I think they're constantly in search of more justification and, frankly, more muscular versions of, unfortunately, their idea set. So you get racist neo-paganism because Odinism is looked at as being more militant naturally than Christianity. So, you know, the Christian identity folks are like, man, this isn't violent enough for me. We'll take on a oftentimes, you know, shift over to racist neo-paganism.
The last thing I'll say, because I've kept you a bit longer here, and I'm glad you stayed with me, is, I think we're at this very dangerous moment where people do not understand. A lot of people don't understand history well enough, in my opinion. I mean, what I see today with the sort of incitement against Muslims and also immigrants, Latino immigrants, I always say to people, I'm like, you know, especially I live in Pittsburgh, so there's a lot of Irish and Italian Catholics, and they'll spew this hatred. And I'll just say to them, 100 years ago, Irish and Italians, you were considered public enemy number one. There would be WASPs that would say that you were had dual loyalties towards the Vatican. You know, I mean, Irish and Italians weren't, you know, considered white necessarily in the way we think of white now. And I think we've seen the targeting of Jews all throughout history. And now we're seeing the targeting of Muslims and immigrants. And I think people don't realize that, you know, fascism will always find a new target. They will always find a new target. And they've done so pretty successfully, it seems like. Although I think there has been pushback.
Well, I mean, every wave of immigration is followed by a pushback that almost always involves the idea that the group that's coming in, they just can't assimilate like we did, that they're uniquely culturally oriented towards criminality, that they just don't want to embrace the traditions and mores of the culture that they're entering. And of course, within a generation, they do every one of the things that they claim that they're not going to do. What you're pointing out is, I think, a disturbing element of it, which is if there are people, and I don't in any way support them, I'm just saying there are people who are against immigration because of those kinds of views. And then there are people who see the people with those kinds of views and realize that those are people that they can radicalize potentially into doing greater and greater acts of violence and acts of racism and anti-Semitism. So it would be helpful if people simply understood the lessons of history and immigration just to make assimilation smoother in many ways, but also that they realize that there are people who immigrants are a means to an end. You're a means to an end. If I can manipulate you, I can turn you into somebody who I can use to my own nefarious ends.
Well, I always like to say that I like to end on a positive note. It's very hard to do that when we cover these kind of topics, but do you think I always think there's hope, you know, or I like to think so.
The most positive note to me, but I have to see evidence that it's happening, and I have to see evidence that there's oversight of it, is the decision of the government, too late, but better late than never, to actually categorize white supremacist terrorists as terrorists. Now, will they follow through with the necessary measures that, you know, with the same vigor that they went after Salafi jihadists? I don't know, but I hope so. So I do have some hope in that, because that looked pretty bleak for a while.
Well, Stuart Wexler, author of America's Secret Jihad, a very important book that I recommend everyone get a hold of, as well as your books with Larry Hancock, The Awful Grace of God, Killing King, and Shadow Warfare. I recommend those as well. I want to thank you again, Stuart, for coming on Parallax Views.
I hope people enjoy my books, and I really appreciate being on your show to talk about my research.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found my conversation with Stuart Wexler, author of America's Secret Jihad, The Hidden History of Religious Terrorism in the United States, to be insightful and informative. As always, I more than welcome your feedback, so feel free to drop me a line at ViewsParallax on Twitter or ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. By the way, I should be posting a raw video version of my conversation with Stuart Wexler for my Patreon supporters, which reminds me, this week should see the return of Parallax Views, the week that was our current events show with my pal Casey, examining the news stories that have gone down the memory hole after their 15 minutes of fame, or is that infamy, in our 24/7 news cycle dystopia. Available exclusively to Patreon supporters. Also, if you're a fan of the show, be sure to check out my recent appearances on the Horror Vanguard and the Age of Transitions podcasts. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.